You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new report finds that roughly 50% of millennials cited burnout and their mental health as the reason behind leaving their jobs. We'll learn more about mental health in the workplace and what can be done to help all employees. Now, test scores that are known as the nation's report card were released today, and it was mixed news for Wisconsin. Overall scores in reading and math stacked up pretty well nationwide, but for the second time in 6 years, the state had the largest racial achievement gap out of all 50 states, with only Washington, D.C. doing worse. Scott Girard is the local K-12 education reporter at the Cap Times. Scott, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
The achievement gap here, our people are saying, is the big headline. What did these test results show here?
Yeah, so, you know, the achievement gap has been much discussed in Wisconsin over the years and certainly in Madison as well. And the news continued to be that there's a problem. The Wisconsin in both reading and math for fourth and eighth grades, which are the two grades measured by this test, had the largest achievement gap among all states. And as you mentioned, the District of Columbia was above it for the gap between white and black students. However, one thing worth noting, I think, is that the average score for both subgroups of students was higher in D.C. in these categories. So even though the gap between them was larger, the kind of average score numbers were still ahead of Wisconsin.
Part of the story here is that numbers don't seem to have changed much since the last time this nation's report card was released. So what do we see there?
Yeah, so Wisconsin stayed pretty consistent with its scores. I believe there were not statistically significant changes from the last time these scores came out. However, around the country, some scores went down. So Wisconsin actually moved up the ranks in a couple places. You know, in both reading and math in eighth grade, Wisconsin was near the top, within the top 10 for average scores. But they were similar scores to what students had last time these results were shared.
Anybody with kids in school knows they take a lot of standardized tests these days, but this one people take pretty seriously, right?
Correct. Yeah, I think it's a chance to kind of see where how the states compare. You know, you can measure what certain states are doing, if they're improving, or what states aren't doing, if they're declining. Certainly, there was a lot of response from different sides of the aisle today to these test scores.
Yeah, talk about some of the reactions you've heard today since these results came out.
Mm-hmm. You know, you had Secretary Betsy DeVos saying that school choice is clearly needed. We had on a more local level, the Wisconsin Institute of Law and Liberty made a similar statement on expanding school choice and that these test scores show that that's needed. At the same time, you just had people highlighting that there more work needs to be done. You know, and whether that's expanding one thing that's in the works here in Wisconsin that state legislators are currently discussing is an expansion to four-year-old kindergarten. And that's been cited by a lot of people as an opportunity to close the gap with early childhood education. So you're going to see, I think, more support for efforts like that that have been identified over the years and then continued pushes for school choice from school choice advocates.
Talking to Scott Girard, education reporter at the Cap Times, looking at new results from what's called the nation's report card. They test fourth and eighth graders. It again shows Wisconsin with one of the highest racial achievement gaps in the country, the highest of all 50 states, in fact. Scott, do you hear, when you talk to educators and others in education, do you hear frustration that Wisconsin keeps showing up on this list of high racial achievement gaps?
Yeah, I do. I have heard that from multiple people in multiple districts. And I think the thing about it is that frustrates the most is that it's acknowledged. It's known that this is an issue. It's something that people want to work on and have tried to work on. And some things just do not seem to be working. So, you know, an example here in Madison is the district's Black Excellence Initiative that was kind of rolled out last year that really focuses on those achievement gaps. And there's different ideas for solutions. Some believe, you know, having a welcoming climate at school and making sure students feel comfortable and safe is really the place to start so that they can then focus on achievement. Others believe it is changes to curriculum. And still others, as mentioned before, believe it's a school choice and more options for parents. So there's a lot of competing ideas for what causes these gaps and what can fix them. And so there's definitely some frustration that in their persistence.
What kind of individual efforts do you see in some of the districts you've worked in? You mentioned the Black Excellence Initiative in the Madison District. Are there other efforts that people are talking about in districts in your coverage area?
So one thing I've seen in Verona, for example, in the suburbs here, they changed some of the prerequisites for honors classes and advanced placement classes at the high school, because what they found was some students, specifically students of color, students with low-income backgrounds, had not taken some of these prerequisites, but teachers identified them as people who might be successful in a class setting. So they removed some of the requirements and had allowed more students to get in. And what ended up happening in that district was not only did more students of color enroll in AP classes, but actually more white students enrolled as well. And so while the numbers increased, it didn't actually close the gap. So that is some of the other thing that can come up sometimes is when these efforts are made and target are available to all students, it may not close the gap. It may increase access for everyone, but that doesn't always close the gap.
We've got a governor who came from the Department of Public Instruction and his successor there, Carolyn Stanford Taylor. What have we heard, if anything, from them in reaction to these test results?
Yeah, DPI put out a statement this morning really acknowledging the importance of working on the achievement gap. Carolyn Stanford Taylor called it a crisis, echoing language she used back in her State of Education address in September. Nothing really surprising from DPI. They certainly are aware of this issue and seem to care about closing it. But as with other efforts, it's been elusive over the years. They also highlighted the Wisconsin eighth graders placing as high as they did in reading and math. And so that was something that they thought was worth it. So.
And you mentioned four-year-old kindergarten in the state legislature. Any other related issues you're watching for from state lawmakers when it comes to the achievement gap?
Yeah, you know, the Blue Ribbon Commission on School Funding released a report in January, and it had around 20 to 25, I think, possible initiatives to put in place that were recommendations to increase student achievement and close the achievement gap. So the expansion of 4K was one of those. There's certainly a lot of other bills, whether it's school funding or the ability for districts, especially in rural areas, to consolidate with each other. There's some initiatives out there that the committees on education in the Assembly and Senate are considering. So be watching those.
Scott, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Scott Gerard. He's a local K through 12 education reporter at the Cap Times. He was with us today to talk about a new national report card showing for a second time in recent years that Wisconsin has the biggest racial achievement gap of all 50 states. Coming up, we'll find out what it took to keep Mr. Rogers' sweaters part of the neighborhood even after the original ones started wearing out. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, we learn about what it took for Mr. Rogers' cardigans to keep looking fresh for years while he was on the air. It's not as easy as it might have looked. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a spooky story.
With Halloween this week, we thought it'd be the perfect time to revisit one of our favorite ghost stories on Wisconsin Life. This story comes from Darlene Rickert of Green Bay. She takes us inside your average cafe, one that just opened its doors to some unexpected visitors. The Rusted Bell is performed by the 9XM Players.
The Rusted Bell clanked when he opened the door. Leaves blew in and swirled around the pleated cuff of his trousers and his polished wingtips. He was a young man in a gray flannel suit. He looked around the room at the tables filled with patrons and waitresses carrying heavy trays. It was lunchtime and the small cafe was busy. He removed his cap and sat down on his regular stool at the lunch counter. He reached forward and tapped on the white ceramic coffee cup in front of him. The man on his left looked toward the cup, then returned to reading his newspaper. The waitress behind the counter glanced in his direction, then turned away. The rusted bell on the door clanked again. A lithe young woman entered. A leaf caught on the slightly crooked seam of her silk stocking. The short strap of a blue satin bag hung from the crook of her arm, and she tugged at each fingertip of her white glove. It was the click of her heels on the worn floorboards that caught his attention. He smiled as though this was the first time he'd ever seen her. As he twisted on the stool to rise, the button on the top of his cap made a muffled scraping sound on the counter. The man on his left glanced in his direction, and the waitress momentarily lost track of what she was saying. Hat in hand, the man in the gray flannel suit walked up to the woman at the door. She gave him a familiar smile, and he grinned. She tucked her hand in the crook of his elbow. The rusted bell was silent and motionless as they walked through the door and vanished. A man on a stool near the door shivered and wondered why. He asked the waitress if she'd seen old Pete lately.
No, but he's so quiet that sometimes he slips in and I don't even notice.
Didn't you folks hear? Old Pete died last week.
I'm not surprised. He's been heartsick since Eliza died. Been missing her a long time now.
They met right here in the cafe 50 years ago. It's kind of romantic.
Silence filled the room. No one moved. And in the sudden stillness, some thought they heard a sound, like the clank of the rusted bell that hung on the cafe door.
The Rusted Bell was written by listener Darlene Rickert of Green Bay and produced by Erica Janik and Anne Strainchamps. It was performed by the 9XM Players, Liz Stadelman-Scanlon, Stephen Montagna, Russell Wolf, and Michelle Good. Sound treatment by audio engineer Joe Hartke. The Rusted Bell was recorded back in 2012 when Wisconsin Life held a flash fiction ghost stories contest. You can hear and read all the winning spooky stories at wisconsinlife.org. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lola Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast feed. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, the Mr. Rogers movie starring Tom Hanks, comes out next month. But already on view is one of the trademark cardigan sweaters that Fred Rogers wore on his show. Rogers donated it to the Smithsonian. The sweaters worked just as hard as he did, and when they wore out, well, it presented the show's producers with some problems. Christina Ruvalis is a freelance writer based in Pittsburgh. Her piece about Fred's sweaters appears on the Smithsonian website. Christina, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Before we get into the how of Mr. Rogers' sweaters, can you talk about just how much of an icon they became?
Oh, well, they were almost a symbol of him. They weren't much more than a costume. It was kind of the way he related to kids. He was putting on his play clothes. He was, you know, at their level. He was putting on sneakers and this comfy cardigan and taking off, you know, his a more stuffy adult suit jacket. So they really became iconic. And for him, it was so important because his mother had knit them. And it was also for him kind of an enduring symbol of maternal love.
Oh, I want to give a listen to Fred Rogers on the show talking about exactly what you were talking about, the sweaters that his mother knit. He shows a picture of her and points out how it takes a lot of practice to make the fine details. Here's a listen.
She makes sweaters for many different people. But that's one of the ways that she has of saying that she loves somebody. She uses needles and yarn and her own hands to knit the sweaters.
So an amazing emotional connection for the viewers and obviously for Fred Rogers himself, it sounds like.
Right. Yeah, he was very proud of his mother. She was Nancy McFeely Rogers. And she would make sweaters for like everyone in the family every year. And she'd have one for Fred, and as time went on, they'd have zipped down the front, his trademark cardigan.
Right. And that brings up an important point. If you, Christina, or I wanted to wear a cardigan, we might not have to think much about it. But there are challenges to doing live TV with a cardigan that you have to be able to take on and off as you need. What are some of the things that that meant for these sweaters?
Well, they had to zip up and down very easily. And they also, the mic, it couldn't get stuck. The first year when the show debuted in 1968, they were buttoned down. And in fact, Mr. Rogers buttoned them wrong. And rather than taking it over, doing a retake, he kept it in to show the kids that, you know, you make mistakes, I make mistakes too. It's just a very Mr. Rogers thing to do. But then they decided that not only did he have to come in and change, he had to do this while he was singing It's a Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. So zippers would make it easier, and they also wouldn't get caught on the microphone as easily.
Now, his mom made these sweaters for many years, but the show went on a long time. Eventually, she stopped making them. She passed on. What was the challenge then for the production crew?
Yeah, she died in 1981, and by the early 1990s, the thread was running thin, and they were wearing out. And Margie Whitmer, she was the producer at the time, said they'd looked everywhere, and they just couldn't find the kind of collegiate, you know, Mr. Rogers look in the 90s. It just wasn't cool. So it really became like the search for the Holy Grail, because they had to find a replacement that looked the same, because the big thing with Mr. Rogers also was continuity, this ritual of, you know, him speaking the same to the children and looking the same. So one day, Kathy Borland, she was the art director at the time, she happened to see a postal worker, and she ran up to him and said, "Can I see your collar?" So she, you know, grabbed him on the street, and he was nice and showed her the collar, and she called the company, and it went from there. But it was very challenging to find replacements, and it took a while for them to find something that, number one, they could dye.
Talking to Christina Ruvalis about Mr. Rogers' sweaters, a lot more went into it than it may have looked like on the screen. Christina, it's a bit of a mystery still. You write in your recent piece on Mr. Rogers' sweaters where they were actually buying these sweaters from once they found this supply of them.
That's right. They took the collars off to dye them, and so they can't remember. So originally, someone thought it was the Canadian Postal Service, but it wasn't. But I called this company that made the U.S. Postal Service sweaters, and they think they always thought that they might have been the supplier, but the company records don't go back that far. It was A-plus everyday sweaters. And so it's kind of a mystery. But it was also a challenge once they got these plain white sweaters to dye them. Mr. Rogers was very frugal. This was public television in Pittsburgh, you know, not a flashy, you know, New York studio or anything. So he was very frugal. So Kathy Borland had to convince him to buy a $70 soup vat from a restaurant supplier to dye these sweaters. And she was a real expert at dyeing sweaters because she had worked on George Romero's zombie outfit. She had dyed about 500 of them for the Day of the Dead, et cetera. So with a yardstick in her backyard, she'd dye them until they were saturated, purple, green, red, blue, and rust. But then there was another problem. The fabric around the zipper didn't take the dye. So they had to hand mark them with Sharpies or permanent marker.
Wow. And there was once an issue when Fred Rogers met a gorilla?
Yeah. Coco the gorilla. He met him in 1998, and it was, you know, Fred being Fred, that, you know, the gorilla was touching, you know, he was very close, and it was this very, you know, kind of moving scene with this gorilla. And he comes back to the studio all excited, and, you know, Kathy smelled the sweater and was like, "Oh, it stunk like gorilla." So she had to wash it, and then it kind of faded, so she had to re-dye it. And the other thing is, they had to do surgery on the sweaters.
Really?
Because the collars weren't the same as the ones that Nancy McFeely Rogers had knit. They had to kind of cut them and do them in half. And he was such a thin man, he always kept his weight at 143 pounds. They often had to take some of the back, you know, take that in a little bit too.
I understand that when people in the Pittsburgh area heard Mr. Rogers needed sweaters, people did step up and at least try to volunteer to solve the problem. What happened?
Well, I don't know that they ever knew that he needed problems because I think they kept it. They kept the whole idea that they couldn't find them just very hush hush because they didn't want to tell people that he ran out of sweaters. But people like home knitters would see this icon and think, oh, I could knit him a sweater like that. So they would just, well-meaning home knitters would bring in sweaters. And Kathy Borland would say, oh, I just knew without even trying it on, it just would never work. Because this had to be a very sturdy for TV sweater, you know, and it had to fit him just right. So that, but people did want to say that they knitted Mr. Rogers a sweater. So.
Now,
kind of a point of pride.
As we wrap up, Christina, Mr. Rogers will be on people's minds with this new movie coming out with Tom Hanks. You are in the Pittsburgh area yourself. Is there a special point of pride in Pittsburgh when it comes to Fred Rogers?
Oh, yeah, that's a huge point of pride. I mean, he really, you know, he's this person from Pittsburgh and, you know, yeah, there's a huge point of pride. I mean, everyone has a Mr. Rogers story and how he affected them or how they saw him somewhere or how they met him and how kind he was. I mean, he really was the real deal.
Christina, thank you so much for sharing the story with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Christina Ruvelis, a freelance writer based in Pittsburgh. We talked with her today about her piece on the Smithsonian website, looking behind the scenes at the secret history of Mr. Rogers' famous sweaters. Coming up, we'll talk about mental health in the workplace after a new report that finds that millennials are leaving jobs in many cases due to burnout. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent talks to a personal finance expert about the best ways to manage debt, and you can call in with your questions. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, according to a new report, some 50% of millennials who decide to leave their jobs cite mental health concerns as the driving force behind their decision. That figure is even higher for workers who are part of Gen Z. A lot of questions remain about the issues factoring into the uptick in workers deciding to leave, but many point to higher stress, financial concerns, and other factors that lead to burnout among workers. Our next guest joins to talk about these high rates of mental health concerns in the workplace and ways individuals and employers can tackle these problems maybe earlier on. Dr. John Lehrman is the Charles E. Kubley Professor in Psychiatry and Behavioral Medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Dr. Lehrman, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. It's a privilege to be joining you to talk about such an important topic.
Are you surprised to hear numbers like this? So many young people in the younger couple of generations in the workplace citing mental health concerns as being important enough to, in some cases, leave their jobs.
Yes, absolutely surprised. But also, I think it's something, a trend that's been happening. We're even seeing it in the medical field. There's a lot of concerns about burnout amongst physicians and care providers. So it's very similar. It's kind of a parallel that's going on. And what I'm pleased about, though, is that people are willing to talk about it because in the past, stigma has gotten in the way. And it sounds like from what I'm reading and understanding about the millennial population is that they're more likely to seek treatment and get help, and that's a step in the right direction.
Right. It's probably hard to sort out. Are we seeing more people actually have mental health problems, or are we seeing people being more willing to talk about them, whether the rates are the same, higher, or lower? Do you have a sense, anecdotally or from research you've seen, which might be a bigger part of the story?
Well, I think they're both part of the story. You know, in my career, in my lifetime, I've seen stigma decrease over time, but stigma is still an issue. I also think that there has been more and more stress in our work environments. Again, you know, from where I live in the medical profession, there's been a lot of loss of the sense of autonomy in healthcare providers with electronic medical records and more pressure to be productive. And as you lose autonomy, as you lose the time to have a personal touch with your patients, you tend to also get more burned out and not feel as valued, and it's harder to connect with your work. I think in similar ways in all areas of work, if we lose our sense of autonomy and don't feel as valued, and there's more and more pressures to get more, to be more productive and get more work done in shorter amounts of time, I think that leads to more stress. So I think that's all part of the picture.
We'll get into some maybe bigger picture solutions that employers might be able to tackle, but let's start with an individual. Somebody at their workplace is feeling that stress, that burnout, maybe in part because of that loss of autonomy you mentioned. What are ways we can cope in the workplace as individuals dealing with this stress and burnout?
So first, I think we need to take a look at our lives, and what's all going on in our life as far as, are we taking good care of ourselves outside of work? Are we getting enough sleep? Are we eating right? Are we getting exercise? All of which are really important in maintaining your health and mental health. At work, what is under your control? Where do you have control in what you're doing? And to focus on that and to try to see what kind of value, you know, there is in the work that you're doing. You can be satisfied and engaged in work, doing any kind of work, but part of it is you need to feel valued and feel like you're making a difference and contributing. And so part of that is I think at times we need to ask for feedback. Our society is set up in a way that we very rarely give positive feedback. We're very good at giving negative feedback, but we rarely say thank you and rarely give positive feedback and take the time. Yet psychologically, giving positive feedback is so much more powerful. But sometimes I think we also need to ask for that feedback too.
Talking to Dr. John Lehrman from the Medical College of Wisconsin. He's a professor in psychiatry and behavioral medicine there. Talking about burnout in the workplace and mental health in the workplace. New studies say a lot of members of the millennial generation and Generation Z have actually left jobs because of mental health concerns. And the same story may be true of other generations as well. Dr. Lehrman, what can an employer do or a manager do to help those employees who may be dealing with burnout?
Thanks, Rob. Before I go there, I do want to say one more thing that I think individuals can do. Mm-hmm. So outside of work, if you are feeling really stressed, I also think it's valuable to see a psychotherapist. I believe psychotherapy is helpful for anybody. It helps you get another perspective on things. You don't have to wait until you have a mental illness to get psychotherapy. And psychotherapy is talk therapy. There's different kinds of approaches. And I think there's even some self-directed ways through mindfulness and things like that can help us in help the way we view things and the way we look at things in our lives. So I really think that's also valuable. And before leaving your job, and I'm somebody who personally has struggled with some burnout in my career. Earlier in my career, it took some courage for me to go to my boss and say, "I can't do this anymore." I was worn out. I was working very hard on an inpatient mental health unit with just too many requirements in my work and not enough people to support the work that I was doing. And I was losing my empathy towards patients, and I needed a change. And I thought about just leaving the job. I almost left academic medicine, and that would have been really sad. Instead, I talked to my boss, and the next month there was more help on the unit, and within the next year, much more help, and I was able to move through that. Now, I was fortunate to have a boss who was very supportive, but saw value in what I was doing. But I think most bosses do, and the cost of recruiting another employee oftentimes is pretty expensive. So it is to their from their perspective, there is value in figuring out ways to keep you there instead of having you leave. And oftentimes, and if they can make the workplace more supportive, that's really valuable. So going back to your most recent question, and that is, what can employers do? I think there's a lot that they can do. I think, first of all, I think they need to work towards becoming, developing a supportive culture in the workplace. And so not only am I a psychiatrist, but I manage a department that has over 200 employees. And one of the things I take pride in is developing a supportive family-friendly environment. What do I mean by that? Well, I want to have an environment where people are able to stay involved with their family at home, meet the family's needs, because they're going to be more productive at work. So I want to try to provide that kind of flexibility in their scheduling so they can be there for their kids' events or different things that are important to them with their family. I want to be supportive in getting to know them. I try to write personal thank yous for them. I want to give them positive feedback as much as I can. And having that kind of supportive culture has really helped with retention and the reputation. And people want to come and be part of a family or a team like that, a workplace like that. One of the results are there, too. I mean, from employee engagement surveys, my department has done is one of the best at MCW, so that it really does make a difference when you have that kind of culture. And you don't. It's not all about how much you pay people. It's not all about compensation. You can pay people even below what the standard is if you have that kind of supportive environment. I'm not saying it should be a trade-off, but in mental health, it had been for me. We were underpaying our people because reimbursement is so challenging in mental health care. And so we were underpaying them, but yet I still had one of the most engaged groups of people in my department because they felt valued, I think, because they had a say in what was going on, because they had a supportive culture. I think all of those things make a difference.
We're talking to Dr. John Lehrman, professor in psychiatry and behavioral medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin. He's with us to talk about burnout and mental health in the workplace. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you left a job or considered leaving one because of mental health reasons, because of burnout? If you're a millennial or Generation Z, according to some studies, the answer may be probably, but we want to hear from you, whatever generation you are in. If you are a manager or an owner of a business or a director, how do you try to create a healthy environment for your employees? Or have you thought about these issues? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now, we continue our conversation about mental health at the workplace, following a new report that found some 50% of millennials and 75% of Generation Z have left jobs at some point due to mental health concerns and burnout. Our guest is Dr. John Lehrman, professor in psychiatry and behavioral medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Is this a concern for you at your own workplace, or has it been in the past? Are you willing to bring up issues of burnout with your boss, or if you are the boss, with your staff? Call it at 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll go to your calls now. Kelly is with us in Milwaukee. Kelly, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Great topic. I'm an occupational therapist, and I also manage a team of about 70 home care therapists at Horizon Home Care and Hospice. And I really believe a lot in work-life balance, and I have a team that they frequently kind of increase or decrease their FTE status from maybe a 1.0 down to a 0.8, down to a 0.7, and kind of ebb and flow based on what's going on in their home life. I have a lot of my team, too, who will intermittently take FMLA to be able to help out with family situations that come up or personal issues that they might need to deal with. And there's really a culture of no blame, no judgment. It feels really supportive of keeping people being able to kind of ebb and flow with what's going on in their home life. And I think that's just so key in keeping staff happy and feeling like they can live their lives and also do their jobs. And so great topic. Thanks for
Kelly, before we let you go,
yeah.
Do you feel like that attitude at the workplace helps keep people on that job, keep people from leaving?
I absolutely do. Yeah, I do. And I think one of the hardest things as a manager, I've had clinicians come to me in the past in other jobs where they've said, I'm taking this time off. And I'm thinking, well, you're not really giving me an option. But it's lent itself well as I've gone down my career path to just saying, well, why not? Like, I want to do whatever I can to help you take the time, to have you feel supported in taking the time, because then I know when you're there, you're really fully there. And I feel like it really lends itself well to a good collaborative team process.
Kelly, thanks so much for calling. Dr. Lehrman, what do you think?
Well, I think Kelly is very wise. I think the flexibility that she allows the people that she employs makes a big difference for them. And it sounds like she's also just very supportive besides being flexible. And I do think that really is a wise strategy to support your people. And I think it makes a difference in retention.
Thanks a lot for that call. Kelly, we'll go now to Nicole in Madison. Nicole, hi.
Hey, I just wanted to say something that a professor of mine told me once, that people can change their career path 6 to 8 times in a lifetime. Now, he told me that several years ago, and I'm not exactly familiar with the data that there is to back that up, but it's something that I took to heart, especially having a hard time finding a career myself. And I don't think anybody should feel bad if they burn out at a job, especially people in the healthcare field. I have worked in healthcare. I've seen a lot of people become really, really stressed out caring for others, called caregiver burnout in whatever capacity it is. You shouldn't feel bad about it, but there should be a support system in place for people who do feel like they're waning. And if you can't find the drive to get up and every day to go into work and you're dreading going into work, there really needs to be a better support system for people who are experiencing that. I just wanted to kind of put my 2 cents in, so thanks for taking my call.
Nicole, thanks a lot for sharing your experience and that question. Dr. Lehrman, how do we get a support system in place to help people dealing with burnout, even in challenging careers like healthcare?
So I think it's really important. So first of all, I think we need to have mentorship in our workplaces that can provide non-judgmental mentorship where people can be transparent and get that kind of support and advice in the workplace. But I also think there's ways to develop systems to support employees. So for example, in Frederick and MCW, we've developed a support system that's a peer support system where staff support staff, supporting our staff. They call it SOS, and they learned about it from another system in Missouri that was doing it. And basically, when people get stressed out at work, have a death from one of the people you're taking care of, or they get assaulted by a patient in the place, a peer checks in on you. They support you. They help you work through some of these real challenging situations that occur in the healthcare field, for example. But I think you can have that same kind of supportive system in other businesses too. And so I think there's ways to incorporate that right into the system. Other systems use ombuds people you can go to and just get things off your chest when you're frustrated with a boss or some problem with your system in a way that's kept confidential. So that's another thing that could be done in the workplace.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Dr. John Lehrman from the Medical College of Wisconsin, looking at burnout in the workplace. Back to your calls now. Mark is with us in West Bend. Mark, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I guess my comment is I've definitely been affected by burnout, and I'm a member of the millennial generation. Happened to a lot of people. I bounced, you know, early on in my career around early 20s through a lot of different call centers as a way to make, you know, a solid wage early on. And the burnout in call centers is just insane, especially, you know, you get a call right after call and you work mandatory overtime, and it just destroys you. And bosses in those kind of places, it's all about numbers, and it just, there's no help for it. And I'd be really interested to hear, you know, if there's any hope for people in those kind of situations.
Mark, thanks for that call. Yeah, Dr. Lehrman, there are workplaces that are numbers-oriented, the churn-and-burn mentality. If we burn out some workers, no problem. We'll bring some more on. What do we do about that?
So I think that can be really challenging, especially if it's churn-and-burn, if there really is that attitude that we can always get somebody else. That may change because I don't know. Right now, most people are employed, I think, in our state. And so there's not as many people out there looking for jobs. And so, you know, when it becomes harder to fill positions, they'll also, the workplace will want to retain people more. And I think, you know, the cost for recruiting somebody can be very significant, and or the cost of a business not managing, you know, at its highest productivity because you don't have people working. If you have to close parts of your business, that costs. So hopefully there's enough incentive that you want to keep people. And if that's the case, then systems even like that need to give people a break. Maybe they could, you know, incorporate an exercise break or something like that in the day that really could help people. Because again, exercise is a great way to manage stress and also is very helpful in addressing depression. So I think there are things that can be done, but you're right. I mean, you can't do it if the business leaders don't want to make those changes and aren't valuing their employees. But then their risk is they lose a lot of employees.
Mark, thanks a lot for that call and for sharing your experience. And Dr. Lehrman, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you. It's a privilege again. And thanks for talking about mental health on your show.
That was Dr. John Lehrman, the Charles E. Kubley Professor in Psychiatry and Behavioral Medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin. He joined us today to talk about burnout in the workplace. Recent studies show a growing number of millennials are leaving jobs because of mental health concerns, also members of Generation Z, and what we need to do to destigmatize concerns about mental health. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, Democratic presidential candidates are holding a series of debates, but do voters really get that much out of them? A guest looks at ways to redesign and refresh our political debates. Governor Evers announced a new climate change task force in Wisconsin. We'll hear from Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes and get a response from a Republican lawmaker. That plus the latest on a House vote on an impeachment inquiry process, all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.